Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. Now in the seventh episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories, based on Edmond de Waal's book, The Hare with Amber Eyes. We have by now understood that de Waal tells his family story by following the trail of the collection of netsuke, 264 miniature Japanese trinkets, which his ancestor Charles Efrussi had collected and kept in a large black vitrine in Paris. At the turn of the century, Charles's cousin Victor marries in Vienna, and Charles sends him and his wife Emmy the lacquer vitrine with the netsuke as a wedding gift. In the magnificent Palais Efrussi on the Ringstrasse, the netsuke find a new home in Baroness Emmy's dressing room. But let us get to know Victor, Emmy, and their children. We learned last week about the beautiful, well-bred Emmy, something like 20 years younger than her wealthy husband Victor. Emmy will have four children: Elizabeth, cleverly named after the Emperor's wife. Elizabeth is the studio's daughter, who will be our author's grandmother and will be the source of much information for his book. Gisela, who was named after the Emperor's daughter, and is referred to in the story as the pretty one. Ignace Leon, who was of course named after Ignace, his late grandfather, and Leon, his rich, childless uncle in Paris. Ignace was Iggy to the family, and he is the Uncle Iggy who will bequeath the netsuke collection to our author, his nephew. Last came Rudolf, born late into the family. De Waal tells us that in the 1970s, his grandmother Elizabeth wrote 12 unsentimental pages for her sons as a memento of their family's origins. She wrote thus: "The house I was born in stood and still stands on the ring." Thank you. Elizabeth's description takes the Wall and us, his readers, through the grand house as it was in all its glory in the early 20th century, when the fiacre waited, always available at the master's beck and call, in the glass-covered courtyard. She describes the servants' rooms lined up along the corridor facing the courtyard, with the kitchen, the sculleries, the pantry and the silver room, the butler's room and the servants' hall. At the end of the corridor are the maid's rooms. Anna is Emmy's personal helper. Her room is down there somewhere. It receives some yellow light from the glass roof over the courtyard, but no fresh air. There is a nursery large enough for the children to receive their schooling in. When Emmy turns left, leaving the nursery quarters, she reaches her drawing room, which she has hung with pale green silk brocade. The carpets are very pale yellow. Her furniture is Louis XVI, chairs and fauteuils of inlaid wood with bronze mounts and fat striped silk cushions. Emmy spent much time in her room. She changed at least 3 times a day. There was a dressing up for parties, for shopping, dinner, visiting, riding to the Prater and the ball. Anna, her lady's maid, knelt at her feet with needle and thread, tucking in, stitching up. She busied herself around her, matching gloves with bags, adjusting hats, tying up bows, doing up buttons. And twice a year, the vitrine is sentinel to a ritual, the choice of a wardrobe for the coming season. Herr Schuster, the dressmaker, would go to Paris to make his choices for the season. Then he would come to Palais Effrosi, pile up his boxes in the corridor, and wait until the Baroness would call him into her room to show her his models one by one until she made her choice. Emmy has many admirers. From the start of her marriage, she has lovers: a cavalry officer, a Hungarian roué, a prince. Dressing up for others is as much pleasure as undressing. The largest room on the floor of the Palais is painted black and red, with black and red Turkey carpet and huge ebony bookshelves. This is Victor's room. Thousands of his books running over the walls, his Latin and Greek histories, and his German literature, and his poetry, and his lexicons. Some of these bookcases are locked. Victor keeps the key on his watch chain. In the dining room, covered with Gobelin tapestries bought in Paris, there is the dining table where the gold dinner set is set out, each plate and bowl engraved with the Effrosi double E, the ears of corn, the sailing boat with its sails puffed out across the golden sea. Everywhere to be seen are Ignace's purchases, Renaissance cabinets, Baroque chests, bull furniture of all sizes and shapes. old Dutch masters and Florentine Madonnas. While for Charles in Paris, the passion for collecting meant sharing with his friends, exchanging, updating, moving, as the Netzuke and the Vetrine beckoned the opening of the glass doors and the holding of the little bibelot in the hand, here in Vienna, the Palais is the exact opposite. Under the grey glass roof, the whole house is like a vitrine that you cannot escape. Finds the vitrine, with the Netzuke settled in Emmy's dressing room. A corner room, looking out across the ring to the Votivkirche and onto the Schottenkasse, with a Louis XVI desk, a full-length mirror, and a dressing table and washstand, with a silver-rimmed glass basin and matching glass jug with silver top. Why have the Netzuke been relegated to so private a room, away from the gaze and the touch of strangers? De Waal concludes that to Emmy, the Netzuke are intimate objects for an intimate room. Untouched as they were by her father-in-law Ignace, they were a little bit of Parisian glamour. There is light in these rooms, trembling reflections and glints of silver and porcelain and polished fruitwood and shadows from the linden trees. In the spring, flowers were sent up each week from Kovčec's. Anna always made sure that there were fresh flowers on Emmy's dressing table, which was the precious Louis XVI desk she had received as a wedding gift from the wealthy cousins in Paris, Jules and Fanny. At Kovčec's in Czechoslovakia, Emmy's family, the Che, had a country house, very large and very plain. It was an 18th century house set in a flat landscape of fields with belts of willows, birch forests and streams. This is the country home of Emmy's childhood, the other face of this beautiful lady's formation. Kovčec's becomes the place to run to from city life as the family settled in the Palais Effrosi have a set yearly pattern of holidays. January is the time to get away from wintry Vienna to Villa Effrosi Rothschild in Cap Ferrat, to the pink villa belonging to Victor's uncle Maurice and Aunt Beatrice. Here parts of the hillside are being removed and a canal is being dug in imitation of the Alhambra. The 20 gardeners all wear white. April is Paris, where Emmy and Victor stay chez Fanny in the Hotel Écossais in Place d'Iéna. Emmy spends much time shopping. Victor spends much time at the offices of Écossais et Compagnie. Summer holidays are spent with the children in the company of the Gutmanns, Jewish financiers and philanthropists in their country house Schloss Scheidhof, 50 miles from Vienna, with Parisian cousins Jules and Fanny. There are boat rides on Lake Lucerne and motorcar drives to the Concours Hippique to watch the show jumping. September and October are spent in Kovacek's with Emmy's young sister Gertie and Ava, and with her brother nicknamed Pips. The heterogeneous Cloud puts up plays, and the children's music tutor, Signor Minotti, plays the piano each night after dinner. December is Vienna and Christmas. Though they are Jewish, they celebrate with lots of presents. This is Emmy's life, cast in amber rather than in stone, the author tells us. But there is a dark side to things, an undercurrent of anti-Semitism which raises its ugly head in Vienna, as it did in Paris, where the Dreyfus affair was but the tip of an iceberg. Reads the 17 novels by Josef Roth, the Austrian Jewish novelist. Some are set in Vienna during the sunset years of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Anti-Semitic sentiments are clearly defined in these novels. Indeed, the Ephrussi Bank and Inyas himself are mentioned in Roth's Radetzky March and in The Spider's Web. Russia are completely assimilated into Viennese life. Acculturated as they are, they do not seem to care that there are limits to their social life. They pay their dues to the Jewish charities, but never attend synagogue. They even brush off Herzl's requests for donations. They do not really understand Zionism. Here on Zionstrasse, they feel completely at home.
The word Zionism today has assumed negative connotations, largely because it is often used in connection with the plight of Palestinian Arabs displaced or occupied by the State of Israel during or since its creation in 1948. But Zionism, the idea of the Jews returning to the promised land of Zion, was an offshoot of the chronic anti-Semitism prevalent in Europe and which seemed to be coming to a head in the last phase of the 19th century, symbolized notably by the wrongful handling of the Dreyfus affair. As I mentioned previously, anti-Semites were quick to accuse Jews of indifference to their national responsibilities because they retained their identity as Jews, however socially and economically integrated they might be in the society they lived in. It was this presumption that had in turn made many in France indifferent as to whether Dreyfus was innocent or not, or, when the evidence in his favor became compelling, to still prefer him sacrificed than compromise the honor of the army, the symbol of French national pride and survival. The logic of Zionism was that if national states did not consider Jews as citizens with full equal rights, then the solution was for Jews to strive for a national state of their own. The first meeting of the World Zionist Congress was held in Basel, Switzerland, in August 1897. On the initiative of Theodor Herzl. Its first aim was to bring organization to the Jewish diaspora, dispersed in many different countries, and ultimately the settlement of Jews in Palestine. Of course, this was no easy objective, and it is doubtful how realistic it would have appeared at the time. During the almost two millennia since the Jews had been expelled, Palestine had passed through countless conquests, and now was populated by Arabs living under Turkish Ottoman rule. However, later on, following the defeat of the Ottomans in the First World War, Palestine passed into the hands of Britain, which opened the door for controlled Jewish migration under the scheme of encouraging the establishment of what was called then a national home for the Jewish people, though not contemplated as a Jewish state at the time. It was later on, after the Second World War, that the enlarged Jewish community in Palestine would succeed in fighting its way to the creation of the State of Israel.
In 1899, says the Waal, Vienna had its Jewish orphanages, hospitals, schools, libraries, newspapers, journals. There is no record of all this in the Efrosi papers. The family are so perfectly assimilated, they have disappeared into Vienna. Come to the end of another episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories. This episode began with the Viennese fin de siècle frivolity of a beautiful society lady. Notwithstanding that dark clouds are forming, her life continues to be comfortable and sheltered. We shall get to know more about the von Efrosi family next week. Thank you. I thank Professor Dominic Fenech for his expert contribution to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.